On this chemistry cassette, Graham Hills, Professor of Chemistry at the University of Southampton, discusses some aspects of the electrochemistry of solutions. This cassette is accompanied by a printed booklet, and Professor Hills will make reference to this as he speaks. Professor Hills.
Most of the world we live in, and most of the living organisms in it, originated from an aqueous environment containing significant concentrations of inorganic and organic substances which dissociate into charged, that is to say, ionic species. These species are commonly simple molecules such as sodium ions or chloride ions, but they may also include more complex molecules such as carboxylic acids, amino acids, and even proteins. In many respects, solutions of these species behave like any other solution. And in considering their spectra, their refractive indices, their viscosities, and so on, we can often ignore the fact that they contain charged species. However, there are other properties where this is not so, and it is with these properties that we are concerned here. In considering solutions of ionic or ionizable species, generally termed electrolytes, we may note that some solutes are completely ionized in solution, and especially in aqueous solution. Thus, sodium chloride and tetra-N-butylammonium perchlorate are ionic even in the solid state, and when dissolved, they simply disperse into free ions. Other substances, such as anhydrous HCl, or pure H2SO4, are not appreciably dissociated into ions, but they ionize immediately and often completely when dissolved in water and in some other solvents. Yet other solutes, such as acetic acid or magnesium sulfate, which also dissolve readily in water, dissociate only partially into ions and coexist in equilibrium either with undissociated molecules or with associated ion pairs, as in frame 1. In some of the equations in this frame, I've used the symbol AQ simply to refer to an excess of the solvent, in this case water. In brackets, it denotes that the ions are dissolved in water. We shall see later that the interaction of the dissolved species with the solvent plays an important part in determining the degree of dissociation and indeed the overall solubility of the substances concerned. The interaction of a dissolving species with a particular solvent can be described in terms of the Gibbs free energy accompanying the process of solution, that is to say, the change in free energy of the system, solvent plus solute, when the two are mixed together. From general thermodynamic principles, we conclude that the two will mix, that is to say, the solute will dissolve in the solvent, so long as the free energy change for the process is negative. As you will see in frame 2, with increasing concentration of solute, delta G always becomes less negative and eventually it becomes zero at a concentration corresponding to the saturation solubility. The corresponding free energy of solution is therefore an important quantity and is itself related to two other quantities which we can best illustrate in terms of a simple inorganic system, such as sodium chloride in water. As is indicated in frame 3, the process of solution can be thought of as taking place in two steps. Firstly, we could imagine crystalline sodium chloride being vaporized, and the sodium and chloride ions separated from each other to large distances, as in equation 4. The fact that this will be difficult to do in reality is not a problem, as we shall see shortly. Secondly, we could then imagine the free ions being dissolved in a large volume of the solvent, equation 5. We should then end up with a dilute solution identical to that obtained simply by dissolving a crystal of sodium chloride in water. The first stage, equation 4, is evidently energy-consuming, the energy change being equal and opposite to the free energy of formation of the crystal from its ions, that is to say, the lattice energy, which for sodium chloride at room temperature and pressure is close to 800 kilojoules per mole. On the other hand, the second stage, equation 5, is energy releasing. There is a large decrease in free energy, the so-called solvation energy, which is also close to 800 kilojoules per mole. It is the difference between this quantity and the lattice energy which determines the net free energy of solution and, in turn, the solubility. The lattice energy is largely Coulombic in nature, that is to say, it derives from the electrostatic interactions between the charged particles. It can be estimated surprisingly well simply using Coulomb's inverse square law, provided we have a sufficient knowledge of the crystal structure. In frame 4, equation 7 gives the Madelung expression, which allows us to calculate the lattice energy. To do this, we need the interionic separation, D, and a geometric factor, the so-called Madelung constant, A. The solvation energy is also largely Coulombic in nature and derives from the intense interaction between the ions and the dipoles of the solvent. I have shown in frame 5 that the solvation energy for each ion can be calculated from simple electrostatic principles if we assume values for the ionic radius and the effective dielectric constant of the solvent surrounding each ion. These quantities, unfortunately, are not easily obtained independently or accurately, but the final expression, the Born equation, equation 9, gives a reasonable value for the solvation energy compared with that obtained experimentally. It also emphasizes the importance of the dielectric constant in determining the solubility and the dissociation of ionic substances, even though the quantity 1 minus 1 over epsilon is not very sensitive to the value of epsilon. It can help us to understand why, for example, sodium chloride is freely soluble in water but is insoluble in benzene, and why sodium sulfate is soluble in water, whereas barium sulfate is only sparingly so. In the case of sodium chloride, the solvation energy in water is large, but in benzene it is significantly smaller. In the case of barium sulfate, although the solvation energies of the barium and sulfate ions are large, the lattice energy is evidently larger still. This is to be expected because of the strong interaction between the doubly charged cations and anions. That is not to say that barium sulfate is quite insoluble. All substances have a finite solubility, which we can understand in terms of the Gibbs-Helmholtz equation for the process of solution in frame 6. Equation 10 shows that even if delta H of solution is positive and large, delta G can still be negative if the term T delta S solution is sufficiently positive. This will always be so in very dilute solution, where delta S of solution is determined largely by the degree of dilution. Equation 11, which is a standard expression in the thermodynamics of solutions, relates delta S to the mole fraction of solute in solution. It is approximately true in solutions of finite concentration, becoming exact as the solution becomes infinitely dilute. It shows that at very low concentrations, the entropy of solution is large and positive, and delta G thereby necessarily negative. I've sought to outline the important aspects of ionic solutions in terms of a crystalline solid like sodium chloride. A similar argument could be used for HCl or H2SO4, except that instead of the lattice energy, we should consider the free energy of ionization of the neutral molecule. Before we leave this aspect of ionic solutions, we should perhaps consider a model of solvation. Equation 9 in frame 5 was derived by Born, assuming that the ion is a uniformly charged sphere in a structureless medium of uniform dielectric constant. In reality, however, the ion in solution is surrounded by solvent molecules of a similar size to itself, each possessing a dipole moment, as in frame 7, figure 1. Equation 12 allows us to calculate the electric field at the surface of the iron. As you will see, this turns out to be 10 to the 9 volts per centimetre, which is very large and beyond anything experimentally realizable. This electric field must restrict the translational and orientational motions of the solvent dipoles close to the iron, and there is ample evidence that this is so. NMR measurements enable us to detect the slowing down of the rotation of the solvent molecules in the vicinity of the iron. Density studies show the local compression of the solvent resulting from the electrical field. This is not to say that the solvent molecules are actually attached to these ions, as in the case of an aqueous complex of, say, nickel, in which the water molecules may be firmly coordinated to the central ion. Where the interaction is electrostatic, it may well be intense, but still leave the solvent molecules adjacent to the ion, free to exchange rapidly with those in the bulk. Can this model be adequately described? Well, certainly not by the Born equation, which represents the macroscopic model in Figure 1a. Rather, we need a description of the microscopic model in Figure 1b. This is offered in principle by the methods of statistical mechanics, but these methods have remained complex and unfruitful until quite recently. Now, with the advent of the computer, it is possible to evaluate quantitatively many of the properties of assemblies of molecules, including ions. These new techniques, based on the methods of Monte Carlo or molecular dynamic simulation, are presently beyond the scope of this talk. References to the progress and even more considerable promise of this new work are given in Frame 7. Accepting that solvated ions exist in solution, we may next inquire into their properties. For the most part, these properties of ionic solutions are quite normal, and like those of non-ionic solutions, depend on the concentration. However, we remember from thermodynamics that the free energy or chemical potential of a dissolved species is strictly a function of its activity rather than of its concentration. As we see in Frame 8, these quantities are formally related, the one defining the other, as in Equation 13. The fact that our solutes may be completely dissociated into ions may be recognized by writing separate equations for each ionic species, as in Equations 14 and 15. Since the actual property of a real system is the same however we describe it, then the sum of these equations must be the same as equation 13. This allows us to relate the separate ionic activities to the total activity, which can be determined experimentally. However, we cannot obtain solutions containing only cations or only anions, and so the properties of individual ionic species cannot be determined by experiment. Individual ionic activities are therefore not measurable quantities, but as we shall see, their geometric mean is. This mean ionic activity, A plus minus, as defined by equation 17, can be determined by experiment and can also be calculated independently from a not too difficult electrostatic theory. I hinted earlier that the activity and concentration of a dissolved species might not have the same value, and this is certainly so for solutions of ionic substances. As a consequence of the long-range electrostatic interactions, the activity and concentration are significantly different, even in solutions as dilute as 0.01 molar, which is equivalent to a mole fraction of only 0.0002. The ratio of the activity A to the concentration C is the activity coefficient F, and the variation of activity coefficient with ionic concentration is shown in Figure 2. All of this is discussed in Frame 9. The fact that the activity coefficient tends to unity as the concentration tends to zero is not surprising. If we assume that the principal cause of non-ideality, that is to say, the inequality of concentration and activity, is the long-range electrostatic interactions, clearly these will disappear at infinite dilution. The solution may then be regarded as ideal. Another way of expressing this is to say that the ideal state is that of infinite dilution. This somewhat inaccessible state can at least be visualized, whereas the standard state of thermodynamics, which corresponds to unit activity, is more difficult to imagine, since in this case it is the unreal product of two incompatible quantities, namely unit concentration and unit activity coefficient. The concept that ideality is obtained in very dilute solution is associated with Henry's law, which initially described the low solubility of gases in water as a function of the gas pressure. The corresponding activities and activity coefficients are called Henry's law activities and activity coefficients, and we need only note here that they are not the same as those based on Raoult's law. Perhaps I should end this section by saying that I appreciate that these formal definitions are not the most exciting aspect of physical chemistry, but they do need to be understood if we are to deal confidently with the thermodynamic properties of solutions. Having decided that activities and activity coefficients are important quantities, we should next consider how they are determined. Some common so-called osmotic methods are listed in Frame 10, together with the appropriate formulae used to derive the activities or activity coefficients. They are general methods applicable to any solution. Another method I wish to describe here applies only to ionic systems and is based on the use of galvanic cells, as in Frame 11. By simply measuring the EMF across the terminals of a galvanic cell, we can measure the change in free energy of whatever chemical reaction is taking place in the cell. Thus, the example shown in Figure 3 makes use of the reaction between hydrogen and silver chloride. This reaction could take place, albeit slowly, as an ordinary chemical process in a beaker, but it can also be made to take place by gently discharging the cell. We should aim not to allow significant current to flow, because this would change the composition of the system, and indeed it is enough to measure the open circuit EMF, and to equate this to the change in free energy of the cell reaction, as in Frame 11. The importance of this method lies in the fact that the free energy change is dependent on the activity of the hydrochloric acid in the cell, and this can be determined directly if we know the value of the constant in equation 18, the so-called standard EMF of the cell. This is obtained by rearranging equation 18 to equation 19, and by extrapolating the left-hand side to infinite dilution, as in Figure 4. There are many such cells which can be used to determine activities in this way, and the results they produce are often of the highest accuracy. In the extrapolation, I assumed that the log of the activity coefficient of the HCl was inversely proportional to the square root of its concentration, and I want now to justify that assumption. To do so is to derive an expression for the mean ionic activity coefficient as a function of ionic concentration. This was the substance of the celebrated Debye-Huckel theory, which is set out briefly in Frame 12. It is based on the idea that because of the electrostatic interactions, the solution immediately surrounding a given ion will carry a net charge opposite to its own. Another way of saying the same thing is to note that the ion is at the center of a spherically symmetric electrostatic atmosphere of opposite charge and opposing field. The intensity of the field of the surrounding atmosphere depends on the ionic concentration of the solution, on the dielectric constant of the solvent, and to a lesser extent on the temperature. If we apply the Boltzmann distribution law and the electrostatic theorem due to Poisson, then it is a matter of algebra to solve these equations for the atmospheric electrical field and the interaction of the central ion with it. It is the free energy change resulting from this interaction that is responsible for the difference between activity and concentration. The predicted linear slope between the log of the mean ionic activity coefficient and the square root of the ionic concentration is approached only at very low concentrations, but accurate studies have repeatedly confirmed the validity of this limiting form of the Debye-Huckel equation. Equation 22, published well over 50 years ago, was a tour de force by the young Debye and Huckel, and it is worth slogging through the derivation to see there are no tricks and no unwarrantable assumptions, at least for dilute solutions. For simplicity, the derivation in frame 12 is for a one-to-one electrolyte, that is to say, a solution of monovalent ions. It can be generalized to include ions of any valence, but when this is done, as it is in equation 23, it should be noted that the ionic concentration term needs also to be expressed in more general terms, namely as the ionic strength defined in equation 24. Having gone to all this trouble to determine and to understand these ionic activity coefficients, perhaps it's time we asked what function they fulfill. In what sense are they important or useful? Well, whenever the concentration of ions is involved, such as in the kinetic rate equation or in equilibrium constants, then it is the activity, that is to say the product of the concentration and the activity coefficient, which must be used. Some examples of these uses are included in frame 13. The Debye-Huckel limiting law is only true for very dilute solutions, that is to say, less than 0.01 molar. Above this concentration, other factors, such as the ionic radii, have to be taken into account. For multivalent ions, and especially for their solution in solvents other than water, the electrostatic interactions lead to physical association between oppositely charged ions. Whenever there is incomplete dissociation from this or from other causes, then additional and often very large differences will occur between the formal concentration and the observed activity. These are not described by the Debye-Huckel theory, and indeed they can at best be determined experimentally. In this aspect of ionic solutions also, there are now new opportunities to rework all these theories using the computer methods of molecular dynamics, and the next decade will see many advances in this field. The last property of ionic solutions that I want to discuss is the most characteristic of all, namely their property of conducting electricity. The term electrolyte means electric charge transporter, and the word ion is simply Greek for wanderer. When an electric field, that is to say a potential gradient, is imposed on an ionic system, the charged species migrate, the positively charged cations in one direction and the negatively charged anions in the other. They do so at a constant velocity, determined by the magnitude of the potential gradient, by the viscosity of the solvent, and by the ionic radius as shown in frame 14. Indeed, if we suppose that the steady motion of each ion is described by Stokes's law, then the accelerating electric force on the ion can be equated, as in equation 25, to the retarding viscous force. For a given ion in a given solvent, it follows that the velocity per unit potential gradient is a constant, which we call the ionic mobility. Equation 26, defining the mobility, gives a reasonable estimate of the mobility, even using the crystallographic radius. But since Stokes's law is really designed to describe the motion of a billiard ball in benzene, we must not expect too much when it is applied to a microscopic sphere, jostling its way through other microscopic spheres. The migration of the ions is, of course, responsible for the observed electric current. We see from equation 27 that the larger the potential gradient, the higher the ionic velocities and the greater the current. However, the single most important factor affecting the current is not the potential gradient, but rather the number density of the charges, that is to say, the ionic concentration. If we define the ionic concentration in moles per litre and the potential gradient in volts per centimetre, then the current density is that given by equation 27. From this it follows at once that the current density divided by the potential gradient should be a constant for any particular system at constant temperature and pressure. That is to say, the system should obey Ohm's law. This constant, which is the inverse of the ohmic resistivity, we call the conductivity. It used to be called the specific conductivity, but the adjective specific is no longer used. Equation 28 predicts that the conductivity should be directly proportional to the ionic concentration. If therefore we divide the conductivity by the concentration, then another constant should emerge independent of the concentration. This is termed the molar conductivity and is the sum of the two ionic contributions, each being the product of the ionic mobility and the Faraday constant. In order to know the conductivity of a solution, we need only know the ionic concentrations and the relevant ionic mobilities. Conversely, if we determine the conductivity, we can, for a single electrolyte, evaluate the sum of the mobilities. A word about nomenclature. The phenomenon we are discussing is resistance or conductance, the one being the inverse of the other. And we always use these terms when we're simply talking about the measurements. However, the particular values of conductance, namely the inverse of the specific resistivity and the molar quantity, are termed the conductivity and the molar conductivity, respectively. The resistance, and hence the conductance, of electrolyte solutions are invariably determined by means of an alternating current Wheatstone's bridge and a glass cell containing two inert platinum electrodes, as in frame 15. The alternating current prevents the accumulation of the products of electrolysis and minimizes the polarization effects which would otherwise occur. The effectiveness of the electrodes in this sense can be further improved by lightly platinizing them. The resistance that is measured is, of course, that of the cell plus the solution, but normally the resistance of the leads and the electrodes is negligible. The relation between the cell resistance and the solution conductivity is a complex function of the electrode and cell geometry, and is always found by a calibration experiment. This in turn rests on some earlier and hopefully correct measurements made with exactly cylindrical cells. A knowledge of the conductivity and of the ionic concentration then leads to the molar conductivity. This would be constant for any concentration if the mobilities were constant, but they are not. They decrease significantly with ionic concentration because of the same interionic effects which reduce the ionic activity, and the observed relationship follows the same square root law. The appropriate relationship was first calculated by another young physical chemist, Lars Onsager. His equation given in frame 14 is not derived here, but has been verified many times, at least for dilute solutions. If, of course, the electrolyte is only partially dissociated, then only the dissociated ions are free to migrate and conduct. The undissociated molecules and uncharged ion pairs contribute nothing to the conductivity, and from the observed conductivity, the degree of dissociation can be calculated. As I explained earlier, the important characteristic of an ionic compound is its molar conductivity, which we saw was the sum of the contributions of the two separate ionic species. I would emphasize the word separate, because in dilute solution at least, each ionic species migrates independently of the others, and with an absolute velocity determined only by its effective radius. However, the conductance measurement determines the sum of all the ionic contributions, and to resolve this sum into the separate contributions requires another type of measurement. The fraction of the total current carried by each ionic species is called the transport number. It can be evaluated from many experiments in which a flow of direct current is allowed to change the composition of the system. Thus, the solution round a copper cathode, carefully isolated from mixing with other solution, undergoes a net loss of copper ions, because although 1 Faraday of copper is deposited on the cathode, only that fraction of the current carried by the copper ions brings new copper ions into the cathode compartment. The resultant decrease in concentration of the copper salt can be determined by analysis and related to the transport number, as shown in frame 16. A less obvious but better technique is that called the moving boundary method. It requires a special set of circumstances for it to work, and if these can be achieved, the method works very well. Two solutions are involved of roughly the same concentration and with either a common cation or a common anion. If the less dense solution is carefully positioned on top of the more dense solution, then initially the boundary between them can be kept sharp, as shown in frame 16. If now a potential gradient is applied across the boundary, such that the faster of the two uncommon ions is pursued by the other, slower species, then, unlikely as it may seem, the boundary moves with a steady velocity and becomes, if anything, even sharper. The movement of the boundary is directly related to the transport number of the leading ion, that is to say, the one being chased. It is the most accurate of the methods available. For a particular electrolyte, the product of the transport number and the molar conductivity leads to the ionic conductivity for the ion concerned. If one such value is accurately known, the value for the other ionic species is obtained simply by difference, because the sum of the transport numbers is always unity. By measuring the molar conductivity of other salts containing these ions in the same solvent and under the same conditions, then all the other ionic conductivities can be found. Although the values I quote in frame 17 are for aqueous solutions at 25 degrees centigrade and 1 atmosphere pressure, many other values have been recorded for different temperatures, different pressures, and different solvents. Need I say again that the theories of conductance are also undergoing a revolution as our knowledge of molecular assemblies improves? Fortunately, the facts are fairly permanent, and we should always remember that experiment has the last word.